Sunday evening, the relationships with which Saul was involved, first of all his relationship with God, and then his relationship with his friend David, who ultimately became his most bitter enemy, and then his relationship with his son Jonathan, who ultimately became estranged from his father. And I tried to show you how Saul was really in the middle, right at the heart of three sets of bad relationships. He couldn't get on with God, he couldn't get on with David, his friend, and he couldn't get on with Jonathan, his son. Now I want to pursue this relationship with Jonathan, his son, because as we'll see, as the story progresses and develops, there is this great gap between the father and the son, Saul and Jonathan. I think a great deal of it is due to Saul's jealousy of Jonathan. There was a megalomania in Saul. He loved to be big. This evening we find him building a monument to himself. Now, if you've got any humility in you at all, you let other people build memorials, do you? You don't get, normally, you don't find people putting plaques in their own honor on the walls of churches or on hills or what have you. You wait until you die and you hope, perhaps, that somebody will stick up a granite memorial or some kind of marble plaque, and perhaps, who knows, in 100 years' time, somebody will read it and learn from it. But here's the man, you see, building a monument for himself, and on the place where Elijah wiped out the prophets of Baal. So he really wanted to be rather big. And all the time, you see, the love of the people was not with Saul, but with Jonathan. And so there was this growing estrangement, and I'm sure it was founded on a deep spiritual jealousy. Now here's the end of last Sunday evening's message, if you can bear me finishing off a sermon 7 days too late. You see, tonight I think Saul was estranged from Jonathan because Jonathan had a better grasp of spiritual principle than his father, because Jonathan saw something that Saul didn't see. You see, Saul thought that in order to be a spiritual success, you needed to surround yourself with strong men. But Jonathan saw that meekness is the thing that wins. Because all his life, Saul surrounded himself with valiant men and big fighters and a personal bodyguard, and this to him was strength. But when Jonathan went out to fight, he went alone with his armor bearer, and that was all. Now that was the difference between the father and son, and it certainly didn't help relationships. If you look at chapter 14 verses 6 to 10, where are we? Chapter 14, verses 6 to 10. Here's Jonathan. And Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us." Now this marvelous phrase, "For nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." If he's on our side, then it doesn't matter whether we have an army or not. We're going to win. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. And his armor bearer said to him, because he loved Jonathan, Jonathan was a man who commanded affection and loyalty. Do all that your mind inclines to. Behold, I am with you. As is your mind, so is mine. Then said Jonathan, behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them. Oh, what strategy! Christians, if you want to learn victorious spiritual strategy, here it is. We will show ourselves to them, and if they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and we will not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, small fry, and we'll have you for lunch. Come up to us. Then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand, and this shall be the sign to us. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, here's lunch coming, boys. Look at these small fry. Look at the Hebrews coming out of the holes where they have hid themselves. And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we'll show you a thing or two and we'll have you for lunch into the bargain. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Meekness, you see, is not weakness. It is strength. Look at verse 52. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw... You see, this is the very antithesis of Jonathan. When Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. Now there is a whole world there between the father and the son. The father thinks that if you want to get something done, you need an army and strong men. Jonathan thinks that if you want to get something done, you just need meekness and God behind you. I tell you, my friends, this is a spiritual principle that runs right through the Bible. It's the most daring counsel that I could give you as a Christian minister this evening. That if you really want to defeat your enemies, then you expose yourself to them in a spirit of meekness. You see, that's what Jesus did on the cross. I'm amazed at the number of people in the New Testament who proclaim and who preach that Jesus went to his death in a spirit of exposing himself to the evil one. You remember he said himself, the prince of this world cometh and has nothing in me. The devil couldn't put a finger on Christ. He couldn't find a chink in Christ's armor where he could get through. Jesus went to the cross, and what he was saying was, right, you can have me now. You can have me. It will destroy you. Here I am. You take me. And the devil was destroyed. You see, hell cannot resist meekness. This is the most daring counsel. You won't find this kind of advice in any other philosophy or system or religion under the face of the sun. You don't find this anywhere else in the world outside the gospel of Jesus Christ, that if you want to defeat your enemies, then all you need is meekness and God on your side. It's taken me 20 years to learn this in the Christian ministry. I used to think that if you wanted to triumph over your enemies, then you argue with them, or you enter into negotiation, or you go in for diplomacy, or talk, or parleys, or something of that sort. It's taken me 20 years to learn that when I want to defeat anybody who doesn't like me for Christ's sake, different with people who don't like me for my own sake, but who are against me for Christ's sake, then ultimately I say to them, well, here I am, you can have me. And meekness destroys them. Jesus said, the prince of this world cometh and hath nothing in me. Pilate's wife said, have thou nothing to do with that just man? Pilate said, I find no cause of death in him. Judas said, I have sinned in that I have betrayed innocent blood. Innocent blood. Peter said, Christ died the just for the unjust to bring us to God, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. You see, this is not just something you look at and go away, the just for the unjust. Jesus did this, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. Have you tried this in your Christian life? Or do you still slave away, thinking that you can get the better of the enemies of Jesus Christ by argument and parley and talk and discussion and philosophy and apology and argument? Do you think you can get the better of Christ's enemies like that? It's nice to talk. It's nice to parley. You've got to talk to people. But the last thing they cannot resist is the meekness of Jesus Christ. Hell cannot fight it. And so, Christian, if you're a young Christian or an old Christian, don't think it matters very much, really. Because even when you're an old Christian, you'll be confronted with people who don't have time for Jesus. When the devil comes to you, sometimes behind a human face, sometimes behind a Christian face, licking his chops and smacking his lips and saying, you tasty little Christian, I'm going to have you for lunch, like the Philistines with Jonathan. Well, just you do what Jonathan did. Jonathan said, well, here I am, you can have me. And he flattened them. He flattened them. Have you tried this yet? Oh, it's very hard. Especially if you're a braw fechter like me. I fecht with words, not with my fists. I never was never any good at that. I just had one scrap in my life at school, and I lost it. It was very humiliating. Ian Bowie, a Thermaloon, and he sat on me at the end, which was the ultimate humiliation. I was Fisher, you see, and he was country. He was a country kyard, as we called them. I was a fool Fisher. But I confessed with my tongue, and it's taken me a lifetime, not just 20 years to learn this, a lifetime to learn that the real victories in the Christian life are victories of meekness, and it's very sore. But nothing else works. Nothing else works. Now, tonight's story, that's the end of last week. Tonight's story is Amalek. And if you want to understand this story, you've really got to go back into the Old Testament scriptures to find out who Amalek was. And if you have the scriptures with you, you can turn to Exodus chapter 17. You see, Amalek's grandfather was Esau. And Esau was a profane person. That's what the Bible says about him. He was a profane person. Now, do you know the meaning of the word profane? It comes from the Latin pro, in front of, and fanis, a temple. Profanis, something that goes on in front of the temple and outside the temple. Now, outside the temple was the place for the dogs, including the Gentile dogs. And so a profane person is a person off whose back religion runs just like water off a duck. Now, I've met profane persons. I'm thinking of an elder I once knew who used to sit whistling at the Lord's table, the Lord's Supper. He had no sense of holiness, no sense of reverence. And while the Lord's Supper was being conducted and the minister was speaking, he would sit whistling. Or if he wasn't whistling, he was chattering, talking all the time through the service, whispering and passing bits of gossip and conversation and tidbits. Absolutely profane person. Religion just ran off his back. It went right through him. It reached nothing inside him, religion. It just went right through him. Now, Esau was like that. You want my birthright? Oh, a plate of soup, you know? A plate of lentil soup. Just nothing. His whole heritage. Everything he had from his father for a plate of lentil soup. You see, religion just went right through him. Now, Amalek was the grandson of this man, and his profanity, profanis, outside the temple, nature, the profanity in Esau, was carried on in the grandson. Exodus 17. Well, it's the great story, you see. Verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel at Rephidim, always against God's people. 13. And Joshua mowed down Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book, and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi, the Lord is my banner. It's one of the names of God. Maybe I'll do a series on that sometime. The names of God in the Bible. Jehovah Nissi, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the banner of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. This profane person who had no sense of the holy. Now, a further development in this story is Numbers 24. And this is part of the great oracle of Balaam, the professional minister. He sold prophecies for money, sold his sermons for money. sold himself for money, Balaam, if you know the story. Then he looked on Amalek, verse 20 of Numbers 24. Then Balaam, this prophet, looked on Amalek and took up his discourse and said, Amalek was the first of the nations. Developed, huge. They possessed Canaan, you see, the Amalekites. But in the end, he shall come to destruction. Now it was Saul who was supposed to bring Amalek to destruction and failed to do it tonight. Deuteronomy 25, verse 17, continuing the story. Come on now, let's be brave. Deuteronomy 25 and 17. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt. They barred the path of God's people. They wouldn't let the work of God go on. They were profane persons. They were just hindrances to the work of God. How he attacked you on the way, when you were faint and weary, and cut off at your rear all who lagged behind you. You see what they did? They waited for the stragglers. They waited for the sick sheep to drop out of the flock. Then they pounced. And he did not fear God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies round about in the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. And Saul forgot. He kept the king as a bargaining point, something to trade with, and then he took the best of the cattle, the sheep, the lambs, the oxen. He kept the best to himself. And then he gave the rubbish to God. See, that's a story. Because in those days, when an army walked into a town, the whole town was put under what they called the ban. And when a town was under the ban, it meant that everything in it belonged to God. And as a sign that it belonged to God and not to anybody else, it was destroyed. You remember the story of Achan? Jericho was put under the ban. And everything in Jericho belonged to God. It was consecrated to destruction for God as a sign that no one could have what was in Jericho. Do you know the story how Achan had ideas of his own? And he took the wedge of gold and the goodly Babylonian garment and he hid them under his tent where they weren't even of any use to him. Poor man. He couldn't even use the gold he had stolen and hoarded up. It was of no use to him. Now what he had done was he had stolen something that was consecrated to God. He had robbed God of something that was under the ban. Now that's what Saul did. He kept for himself things that were consecrated to God. He kept the cream for himself, and all the rubbish and all that he didn't want was given to God. You know, I know old age pensioners who give more to God in a year financially than men who own businesses. Who said there wasn't a hell? God wouldn't be a just God if there wasn't a hell. Do you think it's right that old age pensioners should give more to God in a year than people who own businesses? The cream for ourselves and the dregs to God. That's the meaning of the bleating of the sheep, the lowing of the oxen. I told you, you know, that 15 years ago, Britain spent more on budgie seed than on every Christian mission. More on budgie seed than on every Christian mission that operates from Britain. The dregs to God. Young Christians, you give the cream to God, absolutely the best for God. I will not offer to the Lord, David said, anything that costs me nothing. Giving to God is always at its best when it's slightly painful. Give till it hurts. Not just money, but your time, and the use of your home, and the use of your car, and the use of your energies, and the way you spend your leisure hours. Give till it hurts, because the principle is that only the cream should be given to God. Do you know why? Samuel said, to obey is better than sacrifice. Do you know why? Because sacrifice, what you do with your money, your time, and your home, and your possessions, and your energy, and your intelligence, and your love, and your cultural life, sacrifice is only a part of obedience. And obedience is a part of love. I've drawn three concentric circles, and the big one is love, and the middle one is obedience, and the little one in the middle is sacrifice. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments, because obedience is part of love, but sacrifice is part of obedience. To obey is better than sacrifice. Not your money, not your churchianity, not your religiosity, not your time, not first. Obedience first. Christians, young and old, the cream belongs to God. That was the thing that lost Saul. Oh, it's a pity to finish on something so solemn, but I'll have to say it. That was the thing that lost him his crown. He didn't lose his soul. He lost his crown. He lost the succession two chapters back. God said that the line would die out with him, just as there are Christians and the line of Christ dies out with them because they don't have a religion that can communicate itself to the next generation. There are Christians whose religion dies with them. When you put them into their coffin and put the lid on, that's the end of the religion, because it doesn't go any further. There are Christians, and it seems that they're almost incapable of passing on the religion and communicating the religion to the next generation. Two chapters back, he lost the succession. And tonight, he lost his crown, and he never regained it. Because from now on, the real king is David. God is finished with Saul. He's finished. Oh, he's sitting on the throne, but the real man is David. And he lost his crown because he wouldn't give the cream to God. It's painful giving the cream away, isn't it? But it's the only safe way. And if you don't do it, you will lose your crown. Amen. May God bless his word. To his name be the honor and praise.